Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, with this program, we begin our special men's panel discussion of Jules Verne's classic work, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. I really believe this is a very important book for all science fiction fans, of course. So should its author, Jules Verne, be important. He is considered the father of science fiction, but you could also say that he is even the father of science fiction adventure. Now, over these next two programs, what we want to do is discuss the main characters. Over the previous two, we discussed more of the big overview of the book. But I really believe we also, in these next two programs, need to talk about some of the mysterious aspects of the book. And I feel like there's much more to the book than appears on the surface. And so with me in the studio today are my good friend and literature aficionado, Daryl Hope.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Welcome back to JBL.
Thank you.
Also, with me today in the studio is my personal assistant, George Haddad.
Thanks for having me.
And he is also a junior here at Herbert W. Armstrong College. So welcome, George.
Thank you.
Happy to have you. And then also, we have John Wood, who is a senior here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, also one of my former literature students. So welcome back, Jack.
Thanks for having me, Ms. Lee.
Yeah, you're welcome. I just had to... tease him a little bit with a little bit of poetry. That's welcome back, Jack. So to start off the discussion, what I want to do is I want to read a section of the book, and it's about the character Nemo. I think he is obviously one of the main characters in the book. But on page 204, he finally begins to reveal a lot about himself, and he says... Page 204 at the bottom, I am the law, I am the judge, I am the oppressed, and there is the oppressor. Through him, I have lost all that I loved, cherished, and venerated, country, wife, children, father, and mother. I saw all perish. All that I hate is there. Say no more. So let's talk about Nemo. And he is... a very mysterious character. So how do we discuss him? Go ahead, Derry, I'll let you
go
first.
Well, I think he's a very mysterious character, as you mentioned. He's really shrouded in mystery. And that's what makes the book so interesting, the fact that here you have this main character that comes early on, and he is just, where does he come from? He drops out of the sky, comes from the sea, and you can't sort of figure out what he's all about. You just get little snips of information about him. And certainly this snip of information that you read is very important, because that does help you understand why he's sort of motivated to do what he does, as you see sort of glimpses of this throughout the book, that he is motivated by both revenge and research. Those seem to be the two things. His reviewing nature and cataloging it, and then his whole sense of revenge against something. And you don't really know what until you sort of read this and realize, well, there's some tragedy that took place with this involving his own family. But his person is a very important character, because it's that mystery that surrounds him that you find throughout the book in a lot of other things, a lot of other characters, and also in the places that they visit. It makes it very mysterious and attractive from that standpoint.
I do think in terms of, let's say, in terms of writing and developing characters, I think one of the techniques that Verne uses very well, and uses it differently than a lot of other writers, is he builds your interest in the character through mystery. He builds it by not telling you things about him.
Right.
And then here we have to wait all the way. What chapter is this? Let me just see really quickly. I think it's like chapter 21. It's like two chapters before the end, he begins to reveal himself that there has been this family tragedy. And of course, you know, we do know that there is, you know, they discover the French frigate that was used during the Revolutionary War, American Revolutionary War, to help the American side, and it was sunk to the bottom. And we know that the French translation is Avenger, so we know he's an Avenger. But you have to almost go through the whole book. But the one thing I think that kind of struck me about that, he says he's the law, he's the justice, he's the judge, but he also says he's for the oppressed. And so that really is, you know, really kind of interesting. So anyway, I'll come back to you for a minute.
He is for the oppressed because he says he is the oppressed.
He's the oppressed.
He is one of those oppressed. So he is obviously for those oppressed. And you do see that through the book, that he's actually, you discover that he's helping revolutionary movements who are oppressed people. He speaks in favor of areas where there is obviously oppression taking place in terms of, you know, society. So he sees himself as an oppressed person, and therefore he wants to help the oppressed. And in like manner, he probably wants to have revenge against those who are the oppressors.
Yes. Okay, George, let's get some of your thoughts on this mysterious guy,
Mr.
or Captain Nemo, I guess we call him.
Captain Nemo, to me, is a hypocrite. I think the way Vern, he creates so much detail in every aspect of the underwater world. He describes almost everything to the point where I can see it. But then when it comes to Nemo, there's hardly anything that you're given. And I think what you were saying before about creating suspense through mystery, I think that's how he did it. He explained everything pretty much but Nemo until towards the end, where you start to understand a bit more of his character. But yeah, throughout the book, I was reading, I'm like, oh, Nemo seems to be, you know, a nice guy there. And then as I understood more about him, I was just like, he's a hypocrite. He says he's oppressed. He says that he's suffering, but then he goes and does the same things to other people. Yes, he helps people, but he also hates people. It's like, you can't be both. And he seems to be that way. He wants to be both, but he only sees himself as the oppressed. But the thing with that is, like all good dictators, they believe that they're the ones who oppress and that they're going to be the ones to save people. But to do that, they then have to oppress others, which is hypocritical.
Okay, Jack, let's get your take on it.
Yeah, I totally agree with George here. In a quote, perhaps towards the middle of the book, he declares that the sea is free from despots, which is why he's fled to its safe confines. And yet he acts as a despot and a tyrant to the three passengers he picked up, Aronnax, Conseil, and Ned Land. So, yes, definitely some hypocritical actions we see in him. We also have to wonder, like, I mean, if he's so condemning of the tyrannical nature or the absolute governments that he sees in the world around, what if there was a dispute on his ship showed up? How would he respond? Would he respond any differently to those people that we see, the government, sorry, that we see on land? I doubt it. I think that he would eventually find himself coming to that same sort of role as well. He is the absolute dictator of his own little kingdom as well. Just happens to be underneath the waves. So I don't think we can really rely on Nemo for a very rational viewpoint. I think he is actually a very irrational person. I think whatever happened in his past, the mysteries we don't know about, it's damaged him a lot. And
okay.
He presents this veneer of calm and logical perfection, but I think he's actually very irrational. The way he describes the sperm whales down in the Arctic as evil animals, and he destroys them without second thought whilst preserving another kind of whale. He acts very hypocritical, like George says. There's a lot of actions we see from Captain Nemo that show that he doesn't actually, his thinking and his logic is not actually perfect, and he's actually very unreliable and irrational.
Okay. So let's go back. Derry, any rebuttal to that?
Well, I don't really see him as I mean, it doesn't come out to me as he's being a very irrational person. He behaves as would any dictator. And that is, yes, irrational behavior, I presume, but it's not to be unexpected in a book like this. What I think is interesting is when you look at the fact that the sea is shrouded in mystery. Even to us today, it's shrouded in mystery.
Right.
So the sea to them was also very mysterious. So through this book, you're learning more about the sea as you go. There's a great description of the sea, but you know very little about this human being. And so it's like, yeah, we can learn and see about the things around us. We can analyze them. We can catalog them. But we can't understand the behavior sometimes of the people that are right next to us.
Mm. Right.
And that's what I think that he's bringing out. And yet that's true with all the men on the ship. Sometimes their behavior is a little bit erratic in certain ways. His is erratic from the standpoint that we know so little about him, and we can't really put two and two together very well. But I don't see him really as a figure that is a hypocritical figure, nor was meant to be a hypocritical figure. I see him as someone that comes across as being conflicted, because a lot of people are conflicted, especially in the position that he's in.
I think one of the things that's interesting about him is his excuse or his reason for keeping Aronnax and Ned and Conseil on the ship is he doesn't want to be revealed. In other words, he looks at it, they invaded his world. And so his world, he wants to keep it, like he wants to keep himself secret. And the thing that I've, you know, when you go through it, you don't know to the end. I mean, I think at the end he does prove himself to be irrational. I think he makes, you know, that like when the Nautilus, they go through that horrible situation towards the end where they get stuck in the ice, and then, you know, they find the event, you know, the American Revolutionary, the French ship, and you know, there's that the whole incident where the this giant squid takes his crewman, and then he just gets into this morbid or morose crying, and the Nautilus just is adrift. You know, I think that shows. You know, I think Verne is trying to show he's definitely irrational, and so I think I'd agree with that. I don't think I'd agree that he's necessarily a hypocrite. I think he has very strict values in his, now they're his, and he just expects, if look, you invaded my ship, then you have to live with it. That's the way I look at that. Go ahead, George.
Yep. I don't think he's hypocritical in the sense that he does something and then he says something else. I think he's hypocritical in the sense that he detests the natural world of man, where they live on land, and he hates the way they act there, but then he implements those same actions in his world. So, yes, I do think he is rational at the beginning. The way he leads and the way he does all that, I think it's rational. I think it's hypocritical, and he's hypocritical in the sense that he hates men on land because they act like savages, and then he himself acts like a taskmaster and treats people like savages. So that is what I mean when I say he's hypocritical. Other areas, I think he has a lot of character and morals in some areas, but he doesn't hold on to those. He lets it slip. And I think, like, you're right about how people came into his world, but he didn't have to let them in. And he chose to do that. And then he started becoming more irrational because he let them in, and then he didn't really understand what the implications would be, I think. And then as things started to unravel, he became more and more irrational to the point where it broke him. And I think that is interesting because he kind of created his own world. Something new was added. He couldn't control it. And then the creator was essentially destroyed, which is an interesting idea in this book when you look at the creation and evolution side of it. But yeah, I think he's hypocritical in the way he thinks, but he's somewhat rational in the way he acts. I don't expect him to act good or anything like that, but I expected him to maybe, like, if he's going to detest something, detest it in himself as well. Don't profess something and then do the same things.
Okay, but let's go back. I'm going to throw out another question. I'd like to throw out the questions here. But didn't he give them an option? He said, look, if you don't want to live this way, then it's over. You know, so even, I think even Aronnax struggles with this whole thing with Nemo because he actually, it's Ned that always wants to escape. And Aronnax is conflicted about that. He doesn't want to escape because, well, actually,
It's great research.
he gets to do the research. He's getting to travel under the sea. I mean, I thought it was stretching a little bit, but they even find Atlantis, you know, which there are a lot of people today wish they could still find Atlantis, you know, kind of thing. But Aronnax really doesn't necessarily want to escape. And so he does create this gentleman's world where they have this beautiful museum. It's an art museum. They have, you know, they can do their study of, you know, sea life. They have an incredible library. I mean, I'm into books. I love books. You know, you give me a vast library and you say, well, you have to stay here, you know, for 7 months while we take you under the sea and show you all these beautiful things. I'm going to think that's not so bad, you know. So I do think if you look at all the characters, I think Ned is very much feels oppressed. I don't think Aronnax feels oppressed, and I don't think Conseil feels oppressed, you know. So, Jack, do you have any comments there
about the idea of freedom itself?
No, about the idea of, is he really hypocritical? Is he really irrational? I mean, what's really going on in the book, kind of thing?
Well, I disagree with the idea that he's rational at the start and becomes irrational by the end, that I think you expressed there, George, because there's no real event throughout the book itself that would trigger such a huge change in his mind. The only thing I could think of that would have such a drastic change in his mind would be the events that we don't know much about before, perhaps the death of his wife and his child. So I think he's always had that simmering under the surface, but has kept up this cool, calm demeanor, perhaps to protect his own sanity and the sanity of the crew. Perhaps he's tried to block that side of him out, that really passionate side of him that you see coming out there in chapter 21 in the quote that you mentioned, when he finally rages against this war machine coming after him, declaring that he is the law and he is the judge.
Right.
A very emotional, very passionate declaration. I think that's been simmering under the surface, and he's kept it well hidden throughout the entire book.
So last program, and I don't, because you guys were such good students, you probably didn't have time to listen to it, but Derry brought up the fact that he's kind of like God in his world. Mm-hmm. And so, of course he wanted to escape, you know, the evil world of men. And like you said, in some ways he does enslave them, but Aronnax doesn't feel that way. Conseil doesn't feel that way. So do we kind of paint him then as a mad scientist? Because look at all the incredible mind that he has, that he can build this submarine that has all these scientific things that were in some ways, Verne was writing way ahead of his time, but these things were developed. And even Sarah Evans brought up that even his electronic gun was like the, you know, beginning of the taser. I mean, we have tasers now where we can stop criminals in their tracks. So, you know, so do we call him a mad scientist?
Well, I wouldn't call him a mad scientist. I would call him sort of a warped scientist, maybe. but, you know, from his standpoint, he sees himself as having saved the lives of these three men.
Right.
I mean, these men would have died on the top of that ship if he'd gone diving again,
right,
because they were exhausted at that point from the shipwreck of the other ship. So he sees that he saved their lives. So you would think he expects some kind of something in return for that, and at least their cooperation, which they do give. I mean, certainly at first they do give the cooperation. I think they are grateful for the fact that they recognize he did save their lives. It's just Ned that later on can't stand the fact that he's, you know, confined in a ship and he wants to be out on land and do all the things he does on land. But as you said, Aronnax is very happy with where he is. Conseil is fine with it as well. And actually, it seems like that there starts to develop a rapport between Nemo and Aronnax, because they both are of a similar ilk. They both are researcher types, and they like to study and so forth. And so all the things that really Nemo has put together, Aronnax really respects and likes. He likes the museum. He likes all that right, way of life that's there.
And he likes the food.
He likes the food.
I mean, he talks about food. And now, a lot in the book. And Ned seems to be a great cook, too, by the way. You know, so okay. So let's, have we done with Nemo now? I mean, for a while. Yeah. I think we can probably come
Nemo.
Back. Yeah, we come back to him. Go ahead, Jack. He's got one more.
Yeah, one more thing. Like you were saying, he's that quintessential science. He's very independent as well. There's certainly some parts of that that we can hold up as a good virtue. But he is very independent, and he likes to style himself. He often throughout the book he calls himself the master of the seas, like he has no master but himself. He mentions throughout the book, and it's like he's putting himself, like you said, in the place of God. Nothing seems to faze him throughout the initial part of the journey, no matter what circumstances try to hinder the passage of the Nautilus. His technology, his wits, and his savvy overcome that. But towards the end of the book, with the Arctic ice, with the squid, and finally with the maelstrom, we finally see that nature, the power of God, finally shows the true power behind this world. And he's humble. He must be humbled slightly in the deep in his heart. Although we never really get to see that expressed, I'm sure that must certainly have hit home with him.
Yeah, it's a Verne technique. Everything's still mysterious. He goes unconscious, doesn't see anything, and then all of a sudden he's free, eating food
a Norwegian village or something.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, it's kind of interesting. Okay, so let's move on to Aronnax. Let's talk about Aronnax. Okay, one other thing I had this thought is, remember that Verne describes him towards the end of the book as monk-like. He's monk-like. So I do think we'd have to say that he does have, as they would say in this world, spiritual values. That doesn't necessarily mean he's religious, but he does have a sense of law. There's a law on the ship, and it seems like, at one time they're questioning how many men could be on the ship when Ned gets this wild idea, we'll just take over the Nautilus, which... to me, that sounds like a harpoon. I might come up with something that stupid, because how are you going to take over the whole Nautilus? But the thing is, they wonder, is there 625 men on here? Is it 125 men? But all of those men obviously side with him, and so it is kind of interesting. But let's move on now to Aronnax. What is our real take on him? I think we have some of it, just to make it kind of clear for our audience. What do we think of Aronnax?
Well, again, Aronnax is an important voice for the author, I think, because he is the curator of a museum in Paris, and he's a professor there of natural history. So really it's through his eyes that you're able to see all this detail that he sees as he goes through this voyage through under the sea. So he really, by his very persona and his background, allows this kind of detail that you see in all the descriptions, which make everything come very much alive. They can be a little bit tedious at times because they're very technical and scientific, but it does give credibility to everything, to the report that he's writing and to the record that he's making.
Right. I think a lot of people at the time when it was come out, they would have been fascinated by all the detail. We're not, because, in terms of technology, we've advanced. But there did come a time in Verne's life where he was not as positive about the technology, and actually his later novels a little bit darker. Like Dickens' novels, the older he got, the more dark his novels got. And the same way with Verne, he began to look at technology could really threaten humanity, and of course that's where we are right now. But to me, Aronnax is like. He is to me like my father-in-law was a scientist, and he was just interested in everything, and Aronnax really is kind of like the leveler. He levels the tension between Nemo and Ned, and of course then Conseil is a whole different character there. It's almost like you have the two gentlemen, which are Nemo and Aronnax, and then you have more two of the artisan or the common people. And there's really dynamic between both of them, and so it is really kind of interesting. But I really appreciated Aronnax for his attention to detail, and I got I have no interest in longitude and latitude. I mean, someone else can figure that out for me. But I did think it was kind of interesting when they got into the whole thing with Atlantis. You can just see like all this is ticking in Byrne's mind. I mean, there's a lot of people who would love to find Atlantis, and there's a lot of people that would, you know. But there were Greek writers that wrote about it like it existed. So, you know, we have this revisionist history. How do we know they did? There wasn't something like that. So, but go ahead, George. What about you and Aronnax? So, is he a hypocrite?
Well, in some ways, yes. But I think that about every character, pretty much, because that's just the way I think. But the Aronnax, he seems to be, for me, he was like the voice of reason in the book, where he doesn't really pick a side much. Like he's all for Ned escaping, and he's like, okay, yeah, when there's a chance, but then his desire to understand and his desire to know more, and then to give that, he really wants to stay with Nemo as well. He is conflicted in some ways, but I think that's because he represents every person. You know, every person is somewhat conflicted with what they believe because they have to prove it. And I think because there's so much mystery in this book, Aronnax hasn't proven, you know, what's right and what's wrong until towards the end, where he sees Nemo for who he truly is. And he starts to see some of those real characteristics. So I think throughout the book, Aronnax represents the unknown. He represents someone who wants to know, who wants to do the right thing. He doesn't really have any, you know, negative qualities. He seems to be a nice guy. He wants to do the right thing. He wants to help people. He wants to give knowledge. He wants to understand. But he hasn't decided what's right and what's wrong yet. And he kind of does that throughout the book. And he kind of discovers it throughout the book. So I feel like he kind of represents people in general who haven't picked a side yet.
That's good. I just don't like the fact that he smokes cigars. I think he missed it there. You know. So, well, guess what? I just looked at the clock, and we are definitely running out of time. So we will continue this discussion, and we'll open next program. We'll get Jack on the line first, give him his shot here. So anyway, I would very much like to hear what you have to say about our Summer of Classics series. We are getting a lot of attention on Facebook, which I do thank you for, but it'd be nice to hear some more comments. Next time, we're just going to continue our men's panel discussion of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can also follow JBL on Twitter @JBLiterature1, and you can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. Now remember, you can also leave me a comment there. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.